and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to the show tonight. Thank you for taking time out of your schedule to be with us. And I tell you, I have a really good guest tonight on a book that makes a really hard topic be very easy. I wish I had more time to interview him tonight. I wish I could spend 3 or 4 hours. But his name is Guido Masse. Is that how you say it, Guido?
Yeah, Masse.
Masse. And his book is The Wild Medicine Solution, Healing with Aromatic, Bitter, and Tonic Plants. And, you know, we all know that plants are good for us, and we all try to dabble in eating salads and this and that. But Guido's book is really a good book about how to use things such as pulps and certain kinds of greens and tonics and bitters in a way that makes it easy for you to sit down and read. Some of the ones that I hear sometimes are so complicated that I have to spend months, you know, trying to make it so that I can understand. So welcome, Guido, and thank you for taking time to be on my show tonight.
Great to be here.
Before we get started, just tell us a little bit about you. Not too much, because I have a lot of questions and a lot of stuff I want you to tell us about. But tell us a little bit about you and where people can find you, your website, and where they can get a copy of this book, and any other books if you have them.
Yeah, so I'm an herbalist, which means I'm basically a whole plant guy, and I have a fondness, I think, for the more wild plants and those plants that we haven't really hybridized or modified or taken into our garden for thousands of years, the ones that kind of grow on the margins of the field. So I've been working up here in Vermont since 1996, when my wife and I moved here, growing these plants, wild harvesting them, and helping folks kind of match up with the ones that would be useful for them. Before that, I traveled around the country a lot, again, learning about medicinal herbs and wild plants. And I'm originally from Italy, so I grew up in the Alps, in the Dolomite region, which is kind of in the middle of the Alps, just south of Austria. And, we would walk around and we'd harvest things like arnica flowers up there, and we'd make elderflower teas in the wintertime for colds and flus. And what I realized when I came to the United States, which is where my mom is from, is that I really miss that stuff. It's not around the way it is in Europe. And I think this is, you know, in some senses sad, but in other senses it's a great opportunity, because we don't take the stuff for granted the way folks do in Europe. And we have this great opportunity now to kind of get back into these wild plants, get back into these medicinal herbs, and that's the big part of my mission now. So I work at the Vermont Center for Integrative Herbalism, which I co-founded a few years back to teach people about these plants and also to operate a sliding scale clinic where we see folks for free.
Really?
Yep.
What an amazing, honorable thing to do.
Well, thank you. But, you know, plants give themselves freely to us as well. And we recognize that health insurance almost never covers these types of services, and we just believe it's so important. So if you want to know more about that or to find access to some of the stuff I've been writing about, you can go to vtherbcenter.org. That's Vermont, vtherbcenter.org. It's the site of our nonprofit school and clinic.
I think that's just amazing that you do that. Thank you for that contribution to humanity. Really, I wish they did something like that where I live. I live in Georgia, but we have a mountain house up in the Appalachians, up in the very northeast corner of Georgia, where North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia meet.
Mm.
And where I live, just in this little valley, it's a deciduous rainforest. So we have herbs and things that there you can hardly find anywhere else, except perhaps China sometimes. We don't have anybody that would ever, that I know of, consider doing something like what you do. That's amazing. Okay.
Well, we have a lot of support, but thanks.
So I have a lot of questions that I wanted to talk about, cuisine for medicine, how it came to be, and discuss bitter, aromatic, salty, and mineral things. But once I got deep into the book, I realized there were some things that were just so much more important that I wanted my people my listening audience to understand so they'd get a copy of this book and perhaps can use it at home. So if you want to talk about that a little bit, feel free, you know, the hubs and the three physiological hubs, and if you want to, go ahead. But I'd really love it if you'd start with the heart rate variability and just go forward from there with, you know, aromatics, bitters, and tonics, and tell us. I was interested in how you talked about pulse rate, because I had a massive heart attack 2 years ago. I happened to be in the mountains with our mountain home, and I happened to be in the office of an orthopedist who happens to be an alternative medicine doctor, and I had the heart attack in his office, but we didn't know I was having a heart attack. He was a friend, and he went, you know, do you not feel good today? And I went, no, and he said, let me see your hand, and he took my pulse, and he said, get in the car, you're having a heart attack. So I want my listeners to know things like that. So I'm kind of going to let you have free rein here until I have a question, then I'll stop you and ask the question, if that's okay.
That sounds great, Ava. So I, you know, in part of the mission of getting plants back into the public consciousness and getting them back, you know, into our kitchens and into our lives, herbal medicine can be a really complex art and science. And like you said, you know, it can take lifetimes really to learn this stuff. But it doesn't have to be that complicated for you to be able to get benefit from it right away. It's actually, you know, a very simple and safe way to kind of get started in empowering yourself to take care of yourself and become more aware of the world around you and more aware of the world within you, you know, your state of physiology, your state of well-being, and get on this, you know, this road to wellness and preventive health. So in thinking about how to make it as simple as possible, I tried to distill herbal medicine down into some categories of plants that are easy to get and easy to understand, and also ways of looking at our body that are fairly accessible and don't require, you know, expensive technology, expensive MRIs, or, you know, constant doctor's visits. And one of the first places that, you know, struck me was we all know about the connection between sort of the stress of the modern lifestyle and, you know, potential rises in blood pressure and potential imbalance in the heart and the cardiovascular system. That, you know, coupled with inflammation and the destruction of the vasculature in the body, the arteries of the body, has really made heart disease, you know, definitely the biggest killer of men in the United States, and also right up there for women, especially postmenopausal women, it becomes the number one killer as well. So this is something that Western medicine has really been trying to get a handle on, but having a hard time. And my argument in the wild medicine solution is that plants are part of the fix for this. You know, we can't retreat from this world and, you know, live in a cave and not expose ourselves to any of the stuff that causes us stress. And in fact, I believe that we can handle stress really well. We can only handle it if we're in communion with these friends, you know, with these allies that we've had for basically the entire course of human evolution. And these are these wild plants. So the first place I look at in the book is this idea that you mentioned of just sitting down and feeling your pulse. It's really neat because almost every indigenous healing system, from Chinese medicine to the medicine of the eclectic physicians that was largely based on Native American medicine here in the United States, in the Western Hemisphere, pulse reading systems exist in Africa. They exist in Ayurveda. And they also exist in Arabic medicine that came from Persia from, you know, the 1300s onwards. So anyway, this reading of the pulse is really, really important in almost all traditional healing systems. And it's something we can easily do. And what modern science is finding now is that it becomes an incredibly good predictor of your risk of cardiovascular mortality or your risk of having an event like a heart attack or a stroke. And it basically boils down to this. If your heart is supple, if it can respond to changes quickly and effectively, and this shows up in your pulse rate, then you tend to be at a much lower risk for events like heart attacks or strokes. Now, what do I mean by respond? It's, you know, if you start climbing up a flight of stairs, you'll find that you'll start to huff and puff, your breathing rate will go up, and hopefully your heart rate will go up as well, as your heart has to pump more blood more quickly to get to all of your body. But you'd be surprised, in people who've had heart attacks, that pulse doesn't actually speed up that much or that quickly. The more fit you are in terms of your heart health, the quicker your heart rate goes up, and then the quicker it recovers back down to baseline when you've stopped doing, you know, the strenuous activity like climbing stairs or running. So this is one important measure. You know, you can just run up and down a flight of stairs and see how your pulse changes. Does it go faster and then quickly recover to baseline, or is it really having a hard time changing? If it's having a hard time changing, this could potentially be a warning sign of a hardening of the arteries and the beginnings of risk factors for cardiovascular disease.
So tell us how we would, just let me ask one question here. So let's say we run up and down the stairs, we put our thumb over, our fingers over on our pulse, on our arm. What are we looking for?
Tell us
exactly what we're doing quickly so my listeners would know how to go and do this at home.
You can get really specific about it. You can put your index finger and your middle finger right on your radial artery, which is right under your pulse, on your wrist, right under your thumb. And you find your pulse, and you count how many times you feel a heartbeat over 15 seconds. And then run up and down the stairs. You know, it could be 20 times, let's say. And then you run up and down the stairs, and it's and you feel it again. And over that 15 seconds, now it's gone up to 25 times instead of just 20 times. And then 2 or 3 minutes later, it's back down to 20 beats in that 15 seconds.
Okay.
And if that happens, that's generally a good thing, you know. But what some folks will find is that they'll run up and down the stairs and they'll feel their pulse and it's barely changed at all. And this could potentially be a warning sign of cardiovascular risk.
Okay. All right,
but
that's good.
Researchers have gone further with this, and they've used machinery that can actually detect the moment-to-moment changes. So this is something that's harder to do at home. But the machinery can detect how much your heart is going up or down at any given time. Is it beating faster or slower? And there's typically a pattern that we have where the heart speeds up a little bit, then slows down a little bit, then speeds up a little bit, then slows down a little bit. Somewhere like 7-8 times this cycle happens during the course of a minute. And that's a sign of good cardiovascular health, high frequency heart rate variability. Now, when people get under stress, or when their heart muscle starts to age, or when they start to develop atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries, this machinery can detect a drop in the variability of this heart rate. And now physicians are using Holter monitors to monitor folks and get baseline data on heart rate variability as a predictor for heart disease risk. And it's an incredibly easy, incredibly cheap test that can be done without needing to draw blood or anything like that. And it becomes a very, very accurate predictor of how likely it will be that you will suffer a cardiovascular event. Now, what is really fascinating to me as a plant guy is that we've got this whole class of plants that have strong smells. Plants like lavender or lemon balm, peppermint, valerian, ginger, garlic even. All of these plants, when they're researched, seem to increase the degree of heart rate variability in the person who consumes them. And, you know, what they also notice is that people experience less anxiety, and they tend to have lower blood pressures as well when they consume these plants habitually. So what we've discovered is that the constituents in these plants, the aromatic plants, these constituents that have an aroma or a strong smell to them, when we ingest them, enter our blood vessels and help relax and open the circulation, while at the same time increasing the variability and the suppleness of the heart muscle. So the changes that happen that can put you at greater risk for a heart attack or a stroke are reversed in large part by regularly consuming these aromatic plants.
Really?
Yes, and people feel less anxious, and people feel less stressed, and they also feel less depressed. Depression also is a condition where we see a drop-off in heart rate variability, and there has been a known link between depression and adverse cardiovascular events for a long time. And we're finding that they share this common marker of decreased heart rate variability. And these aromatic plants increase it all, make the heart rate variability greater, and as a result, improve our mood and also reduce our cardiovascular risk. And what's so great and fascinating to me is that these traditional cultures have always included them. Everything from incense, which is basically burning an aromatic plant, to the modern discipline of aromatherapy, which is relaxing and rejuvenating, mood uplifting and calming. All of these techniques are used. Even the idea of bringing the Christmas tree in to our homes during the most dark, sort of most potentially sad or depressive time of the year, to enliven the place with strong smells, to again improve our mood, improve our hearts. So that's why I think the aromatic plants are really important and fascinating. And you see them used throughout cultures at times of transition, when stress is greatest, at birth, at weddings, at ceremonies of death and funerals, at the high holidays. Always humans bring in these aromatic plants. So it goes from these important times of transition when stress is greatest, all the way down to, you know, the dating ritual, when we bring aromatic roses and lavender to people that we want to impress or relax or make a connection.
I have a question here I need to ask you. If it's two questions, and you can answer them anytime you want, but I don't want to forget, and I will. The first one is, I was reading in your book about this, and does it matter whether you use aromatic herbs that energize or relax, or do you just do something that feels good to you? That's the first question. Does it matter which one it is, as long as it feels good, if you're trying to reverse, say, autonomic problems or epigenetic problems or heart problems? And the second one is, does it matter if you use real essential oils, or can you use, like, you know, those candles you get at stores?
Yeah, those are good questions. So for the first question, again, herbal medicine can seem really complicated, and you can think, well, what plant should I pick? What's the right one for me? And if you're working with aromatic plants like peppermint or lavender or lemon balm or linden or even rose, that's the beauty of it, Eva. You really can just experiment and find the one that you're most attracted to. Some people do like the more energizing fragrances and plants like peppermint. Other people prefer something that's a little more calmative, like lemon balm, that is just gently relaxing. But lemon balm can perk you up, too, if you're way out of it and feeling really sluggish and lacking spark. The little bit of citrusy aroma can really wake things up a little bit. So it goes both ways. And as you develop in your study of plants, you may be able to get more subtle about it and more refined, and you'll say, well, this person has what we would call a warm constitution, so maybe let's use a little bit of peppermint with them. And this person has a cool constitution, and their hands and feet are always cold, so let's think about using something warm and spicy like garlic on them as an aromatic. But, you know, you're not going to hurt yourself if you use peppermint or garlic in either constitution, and you might just find after a few weeks that it just doesn't feel great, and you switch to another one. It's very low risk, and it's great fun to experiment, and as you experiment, you learn. And this is what human beings have been doing for thousands of years. You know, it's our birthright to play with this stuff, and it's really safe to do so. Now, the second question is whether the scents and the essential oils that are found in plants that are aromatic are interchangeable with some synthetic fragrances that you might find in a scented candle. And it's interesting. There's basically three kinds of smells that it boils down to that we can get in contact with, and they do different things to our brains. One kind are these sort of plant-based smells, what perfumists might call florals, right? Everything from bergamot to menthol to some of the rose essential oils. And they generally tend to either, you know, relax us if we're feeling tight or tense, or give us a little bit of spark and stimulus if we're feeling sluggish or depressed. Then there are these animal smells, things that basically are, you know, in the animal kingdom, pheromonal almost. And these, which oftentimes come from male and female sex hormones and their derivatives, their breakdown products, tend to either get us into a reproduction kind of mode, or they tend to, especially if we're dealing with males of the species, get us into a fighting mode. So they hit these other sort of sex and fighting areas of the brain. And then there's a third kind of smell, and that's the modern synthetic smells. These are things like asphalt and petroleum distillates and some of these modern synthetic fragrances that don't come from plants. There hasn't been a ton of research on this with humans, except that they found that they don't have the sort of anxiety and mood modulating effects that the plants do. But there have been on things like bees and insects. And these smells, unlike the plant smells, it's really neat. Lemon balm is named Melissa in Latin because it was used to calm down swarming bees. It has a great calmative effect and helps them return to the hive and just be mellow. But if you expose bees to modern petrochemical scents, tar, asphalt, which sometimes they find in cities, right, or straight industrial petrochemical derivatives, they go crazy and they get confused and they lose their ability to return to the hive. So again, the plant scents, which are largely floral, the animal scents, which are musky, and then these modern synthetic smells have a different effect on our brain. And it's really the plant ones that I think are the best at controlling stress, anxiety, tension, and thereby improving heart rate variability and helping to control the risk for heart disease.
Okay, I'm sorry to get you sidetracked there. I just needed to ask that.
Oh, not at all.
If you can remember, go back to where you were because it was great. I just didn't want to forget that. You were talking about aromatics, and we have bitters and tonics to go.
Yeah, and I think that I just wanted to reiterate that all cultures really have surrounded themselves with plant smells for a really long time because they find it useful, and particularly around social rituals. You know, the burning of potpourri and the lighting of a scented candle is still considered, even though it may not be as effective with some of these synthetic ones, to be something that kind of warms the house and puts people at ease. Real estate agents know about this, right? So some cultural elements still linger. And my argument is we should get them into our body, not just smell them. Drinking teas is the best way to prepare these plants. You get large volumes of these essential oils. We warm up the belly. It relaxes the belly. It trickles into our bloodstream. It widens our vessels. It protects our hearts. So a simple daily cup of tea, and my favorite is linden, particularly at the end of the day. And I can sit down with a cup of tea, and sometimes my daughter will sit down with me, and we'll just talk about the day, and you can almost feel your neck and shoulders relaxing. You can almost feel your heart slowing down, and the weight of the day just leaving you because you're communing with this plant, because you're letting it come into you, and thereby your consciousness and the plant's consciousness are merging, and you're becoming more than just you, and you're becoming less enclosed. So really important, and this is a big reason why I think it's part of so many different religious ceremonies, right? Incense and smudging and everything that we see around purification involving these aromatic plants. Now, bitter plants, I think, are crucial in this cultural setting right now. And my basic take-home argument is, you know, we blame sugar for everything. There's all this, overweight in the Western culture. There is an increase in diabetes in the Western culture, which, of course, feeds back onto heart health. Diabetes is a big risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And everyone says, well, it's the sugar that everyone is consuming. And don't get me wrong. I think sugar is way overdone in this culture. And you're starting to see it in places like Africa as well. You know, where folks are getting a hold of soda and they're drinking 4, 5, 6 bottles of soda a day. And you're seeing the rates of diabetes increase. But when no one is really paying attention to, because this is always how it's been for herbal medicine, no one's really paying attention to these wild plants and these weeds on the side of the farm field where all the corn is grown for sugar. Nobody is eating these weeds anymore. And they used to be a big part of our diet. They're packed with phytonutrients. They affect a range of body processes. And they almost always taste a little bit bitter. And that's a big reason why people have avoided them. Well, you know, if we have access to sugar, if we have access to white flour, why would we bother foraging for dandelion greens? It takes time. They taste bitter. Why? Well, one of the big reasons, I think, is because when you look at what the bitter flavor does, and what some of these phytonutrients that taste bitter do to our body, you see that they help regulate appetite, you see that they help control cravings for sugar, and you see that they improve the health of the liver, and they reduce diabetes, and they keep blood sugar under control. So yes, we eat a lot of sugar, but the take-home argument for me is we also don't consume anything bitter anymore, largely because we've had the luxury of being able to cut it out of our diet and still get enough calories, way too many calories, in fact. But the biggest and I think greatest gift that bitters can give us right away is the control of blood sugar and the control of overeating. And it's pretty remarkable. You can do this yourself at home. It's pretty easy. You can find something that tastes bitter, even like an endive or radicchio, which is this red sort of lettucey-looking thing that you can get at the grocery store. Or you can just go out and pick some dandelion leaves, or better yet, dig up a dandelion root. Have 3 or 4 dandelion leaves, okay, one day before a regular meal, and compare how you feel towards the end of that meal, having consumed the dandelion or the bitter greens before eating, to how you would normally feel. Odds are you will feel full more quickly, and you will tend to say, oh, I don't need that second helping of potatoes, or, you know, I'll have a little dessert, but I really don't need a full slice of cake. I just feel really full. I just feel really satisfied. This has been borne out in clinical research, right? So they took folks and they gave half of them a bitter taste, something that tasted bitter on their tongues, about 5-10 minutes before setting everybody out in front of an all-you-can-eat buffet. And then they just said, okay, take what you want. We'll check back with you in a little bit. Just record what you were eating. And the folks who had been given something that tasted bitter consumed about 30% less food on average, not because they were starving themselves, not because they were denying themselves or trying to diet, because they simply felt full. And this is remarkable to me. You know, my mom and folks that I've talked to have always said, you should stop eating 10 minutes before you're full, because your brain doesn't actually get the message that you're full right away.
So how much did they have to eat to get that result?
How much bitter?
Yeah.
Not very much.
Does it matter if it's a tincture? Or a supplement, or does it have to be the actual greens? Does it matter the form of how you take it?
I think what matters most is that you actually taste it.
Okay.
The tongue itself is an incredible detection system, and that's how they think these bitters work, right? It's kind of a sort of almost poison-like reaction that the body has. It's like, oh, it tastes bitter. Oh, I better not overdo whatever I'm eating. And slow, and the digestion slows down, digestive secretions increase to break everything down better, so there's less sort of digestive upset and drama from the food that you eat now. And crucially, your stomach just fills because it doesn't empty as fast, and you feel full at the same time that you actually are full. So if you take the bitters 5-10 minutes before eating, your brain and your gut actually get into sync, and you feel full when you are full, as opposed to feeling full 10 minutes after you were full, and then you put a bunch of extra food in there. So there's less heartburn and indigestion, right, because you didn't overstuff yourself. There's less bloating and fermentation, because food isn't escaping out of your stomach too soon. And crucially, you just eat less. So people are talking about losing weight when they consume bitters regularly. They're talking about having more normalized blood sugar levels. All of the stuff that is crucially important in our fight against the epidemics of diabetes and obesity, right? And so I get clients who come into my office in the clinic and they say, you know, I read about how bad the consumption of refined flour is and the consumption of sugar, and I've been trying to cut it out, but it's just so hard. It's everywhere, and it's just good, and it's an addiction. And I totally get that, right? We wouldn't tell someone, like, you know, tobacco's bad, just stop. No, we try and give folks support. So why is that not the case for sugar addiction and carbohydrate addiction? It's very difficult. In fact, I would say in many respects, almost more difficult than tobacco cessation to try and control your sugar and carbohydrate intake by simple force of will. So again, these bitter plants really make it so much easier. time and time again, people tell me, not only does my belly feel better, but I'm eating less, and I've lost weight, and my blood sugars are better. It's pretty remarkable. So yes, we eat a lot of sugar, but I think the reason we eat so much sugar is because we're not consuming bitter plants regularly before, during, and after every meal. It doesn't take much. A little bit of tincture, which is a liquid extract of a plant, maybe a quarter teaspoon, or two or three dandelion leaves chewed thoroughly before eating. That'll do the trick. It's the taste that is important. So swallowing a capsule of something, not going to be as effective. But tasting it on your tongue, really, really important. And again, something you do habitually, you will see the difference. The other things that bitters do, you know, we've all heard about cleansing and detoxification. And, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the sort of hardcore, full-on, two-week fast and cleanse and purge kind of approach. Some people are not even quite strong enough to handle that. But what I like is this sort of gentle daily detox that bitters give you. They don't only improve digestive function, they also improve liver function. And in so doing, reduce inflammation, help drain bile out of the liver, help eliminate toxins from the body, and thereby help keep us a whole lot healthier, a whole lot safer. Bitters, for instance, in Europe, number one treatment for allergies, seasonal allergies. People take bitters because it improves our liver detox and we don't get as much smoke and smolder and drama in our lives. So that's the second class of plants that I think is really important and is essential, especially if you're trying to deal with controlling portion size, controlling how much you eat, and controlling swings of blood sugar. So I keep a bottle of bitters liquid extract in my car. So if I have to go to the grocery store before dinner, and, you know, if I go into the grocery store before having had any food, you're going to see cookies and chips and crackers in my cart. But if I have a little bit of bitters, it buys me about 30 to 45 minutes of time, and I don't really make those bad choices because I don't feel this crazy sugar craving. So that's the mantra, right? If you crave sweet, try bitter, and try it before and after your meals. It will help with all your
meals. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's you know, the food industry knows this, right? They market to us based on the assumption that we're sugar addicts. All the stuff is front and center in the grocery store. It's high carbohydrate, high sugar, high salt, high fat. And we can break that chain that binds us to those foods through the use of these bitter plants, these wild plants, that we kind of turned our backs on in the United States, especially for the last couple hundred years.
So which bitters do you, you know, are the top five on your list, say?
Bitter plants? One of the most bitter and most effective is the leaf of artichoke. It's fantastic. It's very, very bitter, though. So really, my go-to, especially for starting out, is the dandelion, the common dandelion that's blooming right now. Well, down by you, it's probably gone by a little bit, but it hasn't even started here in Vermont. And in the mid-Atlantic, they're blooming. They're yellow right now. So you get the whole dandelion, you know, leaves, roots, and flowers. You just chop the whole thing up, cover it in 100-proof vodka, and let it sit for a month. Then strain that stuff out, put it in bottles, and take about a quarter teaspoon twice a day. It's a minuscule amount
great.
Of alcohol, and it's really easy to do.
So how much, you put it in, say again the proportions of alcohol?
You just take
plant.
A mason jar and chop those dandelions up, put them in the mason jar, you know, kind of tamp it down a little bit, not too tightly packed, but kind of loosely packed, and then just cover the plant material with 100-proof vodka. That's it.
For a month. And then how much would you take?
About a quarter teaspoon of the strained liquid, which will kind of get brownish after about a month. You take a quarter teaspoon before lunch and a quarter teaspoon before dinner.
Excellent. That's just such great information. Okay. So what next? What wonderful, fascinating piece of information are you going to give us next? We have about 20 minutes left.
Eva, the last class of plants are the tonic plants, and these are the things that herbalists have kind of held as aces up their sleeves for thousands of years. You know, it's this idea that you're going to take something before you're sick. You're going to take it habitually as sort of an ally to prevent disease. And Western medicine doesn't think in those terms. Technological medicine doesn't think in those terms. It says, well, let's wait for something bad to happen and then let's hit it with everything we got. Herbalists think more like, well, how are you living? What's going to happen 10 years down the road? Let's hit it with something gentle that intertwines itself with our physiology and really helps keep us strong and resilient and able to withstand the things that might push us towards cardiovascular disease or cancer, right? So the tonics I divide into a couple of categories. There's sort of these sweet tonics that are sugary. And these are very special plants. They've been valued for a really long time. They include plants like ginseng, which, you know, probably down there in that cool mountain hollow that you were talking about, you might get a little bit of ginseng.
I actually have a ginseng patch. I do.
Yeah, that's just prime territory for American
really
ginseng.
Yeah, it's good.
So these plants live to about 70 years old or even longer. Some specimens are reported to be hundreds of years old. And they've got this sweet, starchy root that has this range of really important constituents. They seem to do everything from making us live longer to helping to prevent cardiovascular disease and keeping our immune system stronger and just making us fatigue less easily and, of course, improving, you know, sexual potency and vigor and all of that stuff, too. But then there are other valuable plants that come to us, say, from the Chinese way of thinking, and they grow real easily here in the United States, too. And one of my favorites by far is astragalus. And astragalus is kind of a vetch, if you're familiar with that kind of bean and pea family plant. It grows to this big bush, and it has this golden, thick, golden root that is just sweet and delicious. The Chinese take astragalus root and sometimes even ginseng roots, and they boil them in soup stock.
How do you spell that?
Astragalus. Yeah.
Oh, astragalus. Okay, gotcha.
A-S-T-R-A-G-A-L-U-S.
Okay, sorry.
And so they simmer these roots with, you know, their beef bones or their chicken bones or their vegetable scraps into these thick, hearty, sweet broths that are used to strengthen the immune system and to prevent cold and flu and to prevent cancer. And it's not that if you, you know, have an aggressive stage 4 cancer and you drink a little bit of astragalus tincture or you take an astragalus supplement, it's going to turn the cancer around in 24 hours. It's not that kind of medicine. It's something that people take daily for a long time, and they then have lower rates of illness, lower rates of bronchitis, lower rates of pneumonia, fewer colds, fewer flus, and less cancer. And this has been very well documented in China to the point where now even the Cleveland Clinic, major clinical center in the United States, has opened a Chinese herbal medicine department and is using herbs like astragalus to help their patients recover more quickly, tolerate conventional chemotherapy treatment better, and live longer, healthier, more productive, more well lives. So I think this stuff's finally getting to be recognized. The other kind of sweet tonic that I think is really important is the medicinal mushroom. And up here in Vermont, one of my favorites is the red reishi mushroom, which is this beautiful varnished, red varnish-looking shelf mushroom that grows out of hemlock trees. But there are also turkey tails, and I'm sure you got those down where you are. They're found throughout Appalachia and all the way down into Florida. Even in tropical places like Indonesia, you know, East Africa, we find turkey tails all throughout Europe and definitely in Asia, in China, and in Japan, where they're used as a first-line treatment along with technological medicine for chemotherapy in cancer. And as a cancer preventive, a strengthener of the immune system, and a way to protect the body from these really harsh technological drugs. We use these mushrooms, these medicinal mushrooms, for allergies and asthma and conditions where the immune system has kind of gone awry, like rheumatoid arthritis, where the immune system is attacking our body's own tissue, because they really help tone down that heat, that fire, that inflammation from autoimmune disease. But we also use them in situations where people are wiped out, where their immune system is dysfunctional, where they get cold after cold, or they get every little bug that goes around, or they're trying to recover from an illness like mono, where they've been sick for a really long time and just don't have the energy and don't have the wherewithal to kind of get back up and get back to work. So ginseng, astragalus, medicinal mushrooms, all of them can be simmered along with vegetables or bones in the stock. Or if you don't do that, you just get a thing of chicken stock at the store and you simmer these herbs, which you can get from a supplier like Mountain Rose Herbs pretty cheaply nowadays, or from your local herb store, or if you're lucky, from your garden or your ginseng patch, and take that regularly, especially during the latter half of fall, before winter sets in, before the cold and flu season starts, to kind of prevent winter illnesses and get a leg up on any kind of spring allergies you might have. And then the other kind of tonic are the sour tonics. And really, this is super simple. It's any kind of berry, any kind of small berry that has a deeply pigmented skin to it. So we're talking blueberries or cranberries, the berries of the hawthorn tree, which is one of my favorites, currants, even raisins and grapes to a certain extent. All of these contain bioflavonoids and stilbenoids like resveratrol, which is getting a lot of attention for reducing inflammation in the heart and preventing cancer and also helping to deal with illnesses like Lyme disease. These berries are the premier anti-inflammatories for the heart and blood vessels. So they work really well with the aromatic plants. The aromatic plants relax the vessels and they improve heart rate variability. These berries reduce inflammation and markers of inflammation like C-reactive protein or homocysteine to really make sure that not only is the heart more relaxed, beating more supplely, more responsive to the environment, but that there's less inflammation damaging the lining of the blood vessels, contributing to the hardening of the arteries, contributing to these cholesterol plaques. And hawthorn, for example, out of these berries, has been very well researched. If people are already having angina or chest pain, right, it improves quality of life, it decreases shortness of breath, it improves patients' tolerance to exercise, so you can climb those stairs more easily. Even if you already have the beginnings of heart failure or chest pain, these berries are an excellent addition. One of my favorite things, you know, we up here in Vermont, it gets kind of cold, especially during hunting season, you know, which is in the middle of November, right before Thanksgiving. And the hunters sit up in these deer stands at 4 or 5 in the morning, you know, waiting for the deer to come out at dawn. And basically their trigger fingers freeze solid, sitting up there, not moving. And when the time comes, you know, try and take the shot. They can't do it, and they miss. So we use this tincture that is mostly hawthorn berry because it improves circulation so much, but also has a little bit of gotu kola in it and a little bit of ginger root in it, a couple of plants from the tropics synergize really well with hawthorn. And, you know, time after time, hunters come back to me in the clinic and they say, you know, that stuff really works. I take a teaspoon of it before I go out and sit in the deer stand, and I just feel warmer. My hands don't get numb. They don't get cold. And I got a great shot this season and got plenty of venison for the family to last the whole year. So excellent for circulation, excellent for protecting the heart, and one of the big reasons I think, again, that we're seeing so much more cardiovascular disease is because people don't eat these plants anymore. The simplest way to do it, if you can't get a hold of hawthorn berries, is to go to the grocery store. In the freezer section, you can find frozen blueberries. The wild blueberries seem to be the best, the most packed with bioflavonoids and other antioxidants. And you can get a brand from Maine called Wyman's. It's almost always available at any grocery store. And you do about a quarter cup to a half cup of those frozen blueberries a day, any way you want, and a little bit of oatmeal. Blend it up in a smoothie in your blender, mix with other fruits like bananas and apple juice. Put into your yogurt, or just eat them by the spoonful along with your cereal. Really
easy,
really
tasty.
How much do you
need
today?
One quarter
to one half cup of frozen blueberries, kind of depending on how big of a person you are.
Okay. Excellent.
Yep. I just want to make one last plug for one last tonic, which is chocolate. And dark black chocolate is another amazing source of heart-protecting, anti-inflammatory bioflavonoids that I think people should consume at least every other day. And
how do we get it without the sugar?
You know,
is it I did that, and it gave me diabetes.
Well, you got to make sure that you're not eating high sugar, high milk chocolate. So it's got to be 75, maybe even 80% cacao.
Okay.
Very low sugar content. Actually tastes kind of bitter.
Okay.
The easiest way to do it is to get just cocoa powder without any sugar added at all. And then you can control your own, or you can use a little bit of stevia as a sweetener instead of using sugar. And you just mix it with some warm milk or some warm almond milk or soy milk or even just hot water. And if you want to do it like the Mayans in Central America, you mix a little pinch of cayenne in there, too, to kind of give it a little kick. And that's an amazing, amazing circulatory tonic. You know, a small pinch of stevia leaf, a tablespoon or two of cacao powder or cocoa powder, and a tiny trace of cayenne or hot sauce. Really good stuff with hot water.
About 7 or 8 minutes, 9 minutes, something like that. Can you talk a few minutes about epigenetics and anything you know that can stop the genes from expressing?
That's a fascinating topic that is definitely very hot right now. And what seems to be the case is that our body's genome is actually kind of like an antenna to the outside world. It's listening to signals from outside of us, from what we eat, from what we breathe, from what we get in through our skin. And based on those signals and those cues, altering the way our cells behave. It's actually pretty incredible. It's altering the cells in a way that can be passed on to our children, depending on what we're doing before we conceive and for moms while they're pregnant. And this is based on locking and unlocking and opening and closing different pieces of our genetic code. It's not all open and available. In fact, at any given time, certain genes that connect to inflammation might be really active and going crazy, and if they are, you tend to see more heart disease and more cancer. In other folks or at other times, those genes might be locked up, so the cell can't behave in a way that contributes to heart disease or cancer anymore. Plant constituents, from the tonics in particular, have a profound effect on modulating what genes are on and what genes are off, right? So if the cell is already tumorous or cancerous, it can help turn off or shut down those oncogenes. We see this with bioflavonoids from the berries, like the hawthorn and the blueberry or the chocolate. We also see it from things that are called saponins that you find in ginseng roots or in astragalus roots or in the medicinal mushrooms, for instance. And then if a cell is healthy, consuming those constituents will tend to turn off the genes that relate to inflammation, the genes that relate to damage, and the genes that would make those cells sort of die more quickly. So they slow down the aging process for those cells, and they reduce inflammation.
So,
One constituent from grapes, resveratrol, also found in the root of Japanese knotweed, has received a ton of attention because it tends to slow down the aging of all the cells throughout the body, as well as preventing cancer. When they gave high doses of resveratrol to fruit flies, for instance, they found that they lived almost twice as long as they would have otherwise.
Wow.
Pretty incredible stuff. And again, you know, the sooner we can get more of these things into our bodies and into the bodies of our children, the better off we'll be as a culture, as a species, as a family, as individuals.
So for things like, and we got about 5 minutes, okay? And I want you to take, you know, 30 seconds at the end and remind people of your website and the name of your book again, okay? But in the meantime, for things like MTHFR, you're saying
mm-hmm.
that people will start doing whichever herbs, and you might want to say what those are, that they can switch that off or make it not at stress?
With the methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase problem, you first of all need to consume a lot of folate. Right, and to a certain extent, you get huge quantities of that from eating greens, you know, wild plant greens as well as regular cultivated greens. But yes, you can regulate the expression of your genes and potentially activate or inactivate genes that have gone kind of awry or gone off the sort of correct trail. I don't know of any specific link that has been established in humans although they're looking at those genes in animal models. But I don't know of a specific link with MTHFR in, let's say, bioflavonoids in humans, where there's been a trial done on that yet. But what we have seen is trials done for vascular inflammation, heart disease, and cancer prevention. And at the very least, I think you would find an improvement in health without a doubt by consuming these plants. And it may very well be that they will find in the near future that you can reverse those types of changes using daily habitual tonic plants like the hawthorn berry, the medicinal mushrooms, and herbs like ginseng root.
Well, that's really wonderful to know. That's the first time I've heard somebody actually say those words. You can use plants to stop it, cause genes to stop expressing. Even though we know it's diet, but it, I don't know. It just hit me a different way when I read it in your book. So
diet is really important, right? But a lot of the vegetables we consume are really stripped of many of their phytonutrients, and they're not as powerful or effective as these wild plants are. So, you know, when I talk about a cuisine for medicine in the book, what I'm really trying to get folks to realize is that herbal medicine isn't something you take for a problem. It's more, you know, we've heard about food as medicine, and with these wild plants, it's more like medicine as food. It's a medicine you take every day, kind of like, you know, you wouldn't say, well, I'm just going to wait till I'm grossly underweight and starving before I eat. No, I'm going to just eat every day to maintain my health. Similarly, you shouldn't wait for problems to happen before you start taking medicinal plants. You should consume them regularly on a daily basis. And a big part of why we see these problems today is because people just don't do that anymore. And they're not doing it in the cities. They're even not doing it in the country that much anymore. And people say, like, oh, yeah, my grandmother used to know about that stuff. Or, yeah, bitters go in my Manhattan, right? It's a cocktail additive.
Yeah,
certainly,
you know,
true.
Unfortunately, like, one of the things where our place is up in the mountains, an unfortunate thing that maybe this is my perspective, but this is what I believe to have witnessed. Some of the people up there that have been farming, you know, a lot of those people have never been outside the county. There's teenagers that help us farm, work our property, that are like a senior in high school, they've never been outside the county. So what I've found is that many of them think that when they get to where they can afford to go out to McDonald's every day, that's they're meeting a level of success. So the whole county's full of diabetes and mood disorders and addictions. So they're not understanding that they really have the way to go to begin with.
Well, unfortunately, that's not an uncommon story. And you're starting to see that exported to other areas of the world as well. My point is that we shouldn't just condemn the McDonald's. Our bodies can handle McDonald's, but they can only handle it if we are connected to these wild plants that have been part of our evolutionary history for hundreds of thousands of years. And that's why I call it the wild medicine solution. You know, it's not the stop everything you're doing, the world's going to kill you solution. No, it's, you know, live the life that you have, but add in this wild medicine. Add it in on a daily basis. Make it a daily healing habit. Think of your medicine as food and go out and get it locally. Add it to what you're eating or steep it in vodka and take it as a tincture or an extract. You'll find your life will benefit. And if your kids watch you do that, then this tradition will come back and we'll do it consciously. We'll not just do it because our grandmothers did it. We'll do it because we know and we have the scientific evidence now that it helps prevent cardiovascular disease. It helps prevent cancer. It helps deal with mood problems. It helps deal with all those things you talk about that come from this disconnected fast food culture. We can have our fast food, but we need to have our wild plants too, okay? And if we can do those two things together, what we'll find is that the fast food culture will begin to have less and less of a grip on us because the wild allies will hold us steady, hold us grounded and rooted in the history of our species, keep us communing with the ecology and the consciousness that is around us, which is what I think their greatest gift is. So, you know, that's what we do at the clinic here in Vermont. And it's at vtherbcenter.org, and you can check it out there. Or read about my book, The Wild Medicine Solution.
You're great. Thank you. Pleasure to have you, really.
It was a great pleasure for me. I had a great time, Ava. Thanks. And I definitely would look forward to speaking with you in the future around topics in cardiovascular disease. And
we'll do it.
You know,
we'll
I know you got a personal story around there, so we'll talk.
Thank you. Have a good evening, okay? Thank you.
Good night. Same to you. Good night.